Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Thanks for joining me on New Books in Islamic Studies, Dr. Wa. I'm excited to talk to you about your new book and hear about your long and illustrious career in Islamic Studies. So thanks for making the time to talk to me.
Well, I'm delighted to be here. Great to talk to you.
So we always begin these conversations with a little bit about our authors. And I'm wondering if you could start with kind of the initial things that brought you to the study of Islam. If you could tell us a little bit about some of your training in Islamic studies at the University of Chicago. You were there at a really exciting period with some very influential teachers, but also some wonderful colleagues. One of my advisors, Frederick Denny, was there with you, I believe. So could you tell us kind of what got you into Islamic studies, and then how did your kind of graduate training and early formative years shape the things you do?
Sure, I can talk about that a little bit. I got into this after I studied at McMaster University in Hamilton, and I graduated in philosophy and history. A BA in philosophy and history in 1959, which sounds like ages ago, but at any rate, and part of that period of time you might remember was linguistic analysis in philosophy, and I found that to be totally inadequate to deal with the religious phenomenon that was all over the place, and in fact was I thought was far more important in social and cultural development than philosophy at the time was giving it. So I completed a master's degree there in philosophy, and I went on then to do a master's degree at the University of Chicago, and one of in the Divinity School at Chicago, and where Mircea Eliade was, and he had instituted the new study of the history of religions, and I thought that was a critical and new stance to take. So I went there to study. I did an MA in 68, and then one of the requirements of the Divinity School at the time was that if you're studying, you know, the general history of religions, that is the kind of philosophical perspective, you had to add a religious tradition so that you knew what to apply from your more philosophical studies into a religious tradition. Well, as you probably know, at that time, there was all kinds of emphasis on Buddhism and Hinduism in the United States, with several gurus being predominant. And nobody at the University of Chicago in the Divinity School was looking at Islam. And so I said to Eliade one day, you know, I'd like to focus on Islamic studies. I'd like to focus on Islam and try to see how Islam fits into the history of religions. Well, he wasn't that very excited. He said, well, You know, we Islam is not greatly amenable to history of religions categories. And so I said, well, that seems strange. If the history of religions categories are supposed to address, you know, the broad scope of religion, I think then Islam should be part of that family of studies. Everybody else at Chicago, of course, was studying Hinduism, and you know, there were several important scholars in Hinduism at the time. But I prevailed. I said, no, I think we ought to see how Islamic studies fits into the whole program of the history of religions and see if there are aspects of it that are important. So I went ahead with it. I did a master's degree in 1968. Then I began studying Islam and in the Oriental Institute, and at the time Fazl Rahman came. I took classes with Fazl Rahman. Fred Denny came to the Divinity School, and several of us were quite interested in Islamic studies. And so from then on, I focused my attention on Islam and other kinds of minority traditions like that. So then I went to Cairo, Egypt, to study Arabic at the American University in Cairo. And then I returned and completed my PhD in 1972 at the University of Chicago. So, as you probably know, the history of religions was, I guess, the flavor of the year for several years in Chicago, and there was all kinds of emphasis on the history, an analysis of epics and the times that history itself expressed through religious understandings. So I thought, well, maybe we should apply this kind of grid to Islam to see how it would work and if it would work. I did a thesis there on symbolism in Islam, focusing specifically on, I guess you would call it, symbols within the historical development of Islamic theology. And then I began to teach, and I went first of all to Indiana University and taught there for a year. Then I went to Cleveland State and taught there for a couple of years. And then I went to the University of Alberta in 1974 and became an assistant professor in religious studies then. So behind all that, however, was, you know, a personal quest to understand how Islam fit into and related to the larger circle of development of culture in the West, and in fact how Islam seems to stand across several divides in religious studies. So, for example, it's pretty clear that Islam had something to do with the whole philosophical and scientific development of European culture. And it was pretty clear that Islam had something to do with the way in which Christianity in the Middle East defined itself. And so the various dimensions of Islam seem not to have been explored by the academy in the West. And I thought that was a kind of blind spot, if you will, in the way in which people were looking at Islam, because it became so foreign, which in fact It was not, because it was integral, in fact, to the way in which European culture developed and the way in which I saw philosophical and medical culture develop. So from that time on, then, I began to look at Islam as a dimension of, or at least an important aspect of, the way in which the West itself had defined itself religiously. So that's a kind of overview on how I came to the University of Alberta as an assistant professor and immediately I interacted with the folks over at Al Rashid Mosque.
Yeah, that's a really interesting history that you've been part of. And knowing kind of the broader trajectories of your work, I know that you've been working on Muslims in Canada for a while. But I know that you're probably more well known for a lot of your work on Muslims in places like Morocco or Egypt, and to probably some other folks, to some of your work on indigenous religions. So in terms of this book on the community there in Edmonton, I could probably guess a little bit of how the story might have started, but what made you decide to write this book? How did your kind of familiarity with the history of the community start to develop more than just, you know, probably your personal interactions with the community? What made you decide to kind of flesh this out?
Well, that's a kind of interesting story because, as you probably know from some of my first publications, one of my first ones was on the Mujahideen of Egypt, which was a study of the Sufi chanter in Egypt. And because when I was there at the university, at the American University in Cairo, I was intrigued by the Sufi groups and the chant, and in fact, how it was that this kind of religious format took the dimensions it is. So I decided I would go back and study that. And what that study gave me was a perspective into the broad, what I would call, cultural landscape of Islam, that Islam could not be fixed as what I would call a theological system. It could not be fixed as a kind of conservative religious tradition because it had many different dimensions. And so I mentioned that book because when I came back to Canada then and was interacting with the people over at Al Rashid, I saw that tradition in Alberta took on its own kind of character. In other words, that Islam was malleable and could adapt to many different kinds of cultural contexts. And in fact, Muslims could take their tradition and adapt it to what I thought was a really significant kind of thing. So I began very early then making notes about Al Rashid, and of course Al Rashid had, at the time, it had the, it had all kinds of traditions said about it, going back to 1890s, you know, when Peter Bakker, you know, came out of Montreal and was a peddler in the north, and there are all kinds of stories about how Muslims had an impact on the Cree people. For example, Ali Abu Shadi was, an individual who traveled across the north with pots and pans, and he learned to speak Cree, and in fact he developed some Cree words for pots and pans, and so he would go into a Cree community and he would, you know, sell these things. And Peter Bakker was explorer, and so these chaps fascinated me, and their interaction with the indigenous people fascinated me. So, so the connection between the Muslims and indigenous people began very early in my career there, because I saw these as two very dynamic kinds of cultural expressions interacting quite outside what we would call a theological framework. So that's how I got more and more interested in how Al-Rashid had developed. And at the same time, I had developed a secondary interest in indigenous studies, and had worked considerably behind the scenes, that is, intellectually, with people who had done history of religions kind of work on indigenous peoples around the world. So when I came to Alberta, one of the first things I did was to bring together elders and scholars to discuss the way in which indigenous people fit into a history of religions format. So, in a way, my study in Islam opened up ways in which I could study traditional peoples, and most particularly the Cree in Northern Alberta. So that's a kind of overview of how the Islamic studies and indigenous studies fit into my overall perspective, and how I got started on it. So these two areas then have attracted me all my life. And it's interesting to point out that when I held a conference of international elders and scholars, one of the individuals who came to that conference was Sister Nancy LeClaire. And Sister Nancy LeClaire was a Cree lady from Hobima in Alberta. And she came to my office after the conference and said, you know, I want you to help me write a Cree dictionary. I said, Sister Nancy, I've studied Arabic, not Cree, and so I can't do that. She said, no, you have to do it. I've talked to my Powhatan, and you have to help me with this. Well, if you look at my CV, you can see that 27 years later, we produced the Alberta Elders Cree Dictionary. And therein is another story, but I won't go there today.
I'm sure you have a number of stories.
Yeah.
They're thinking about the history of Muslims in North America. There's a lot of scholarship on Islam in the U.S., and there's a number of history books now that kind of try to outline the long durée, and you know, lots of wonderful case studies, of course, and the history of Islam in Canada. From what I can tell, and forgive me if I'm describing it, but there seems to be less scholarship, and specifically monographs on the history of Muslims in Canada. While your book is kind of zoomed into this one community, it really kind of provides a lot of the framework for thinking about this broader history. So I'm wondering if you could just kind of help us think about, what you think the differences between the study of Islam in Canada versus the study of Islam in America or the U.S. Why do you think there's this kind of discrepancy? Why do you think there's been less focus on the history of Muslims in Canada?
Well, one of the reasons, I think, is because historians have ignored Islam as a constituent element of Canadian culture. The same way that scholars have ignored the constituency of the indigenous people, so that there have been major themes in history written of how Canada became Canada that have not focused on the social and cultural contributions of minorities to the complexity of Canadian development. And the overwhelming presence of English history and what we would call the official history then downplays the significance of ethnic and minority traditions in the overall complexity. In it seems to me that in the United States there has been a far greater scholarship in ethnicity and in minority traditions than in Canada, and in the role that they played. And so I think that scholarship in part of it has in the States has been because of what we would call ethnic scholars have decided to explore their own tradition through their scholarship. Whereas in Canada, we don't seem to have had that same kind of emphasis among ethnic scholars to do that kind of thing. So the other reason might be that Canada is very diverse across the country and is spread apart. And so the interaction between, let's say, Islamic groups in Alberta or Islamic groups in Ontario is very tenuous, and they haven't the institutional structures that would bring them together and would raise them to public consciousness. So therefore, the significance, I think, of Islam or other minority traditions is that they're regarded as totally local and not significant in the overall notion of Canadian development. That's one of the features that I think about the Canadian versus the American situation. I don't find that in the United States, where there's a continuous push to try to understand the role of that minorities or particular viewpoints have played in the composite that is the USA.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So your book focuses on this community around the Al Rashid Mosque, and it's a very long history. This was the first mosque to be built in Canada, and you start this history not with the building of the mosque, but just prior to that. So can you give us a little snapshot of what the Muslim population in Canada looked like in the late 19th and early 20th century? And what might have brought Muslims to Edmonton in particular?
Well, that's an interesting question, because it wasn't formed like Islam in Alberta was not formed there because of any kind of pre-perceived need to evangelize Canadians or to establish an Islamic viewpoint in Canada. Really, it was the exploration of the early fur traders who came from Lebanon around the turn of the 1900, and they came here totally as entrepreneurs, so that the early Muslims in Alberta, for example, were all families interrelated because of entrepreneurial interests. In other words, they were businessmen. So Alberta was graced, I think, by some very, very forward-thinking and positive business people in the Arabic-speaking and Islamic community. Now, why they got to Edmonton was because that was a trading post very early in the fur trade. And some of the early people related to that fur trade network, so to speak. And they basically brought materials from Montreal through Winnipeg and then up to the north and into places like Lac La Biche and then to Edmonton. And so very early on, it was not a religious motivation that brought them here. It was more what I would call an extension of opportunity. And so they came to Alberta to promote business, to develop business, and many of these businesses were built on what I would call a family interrelationship and compact. A cousin or a son would be welcomed here and would be helped in Canada by a relative to get started in a business, and from there it grew. So I see one of the important dimensions of Al Rashid Mosque is these essential family structures out of Lebanon built on a business concern and built with the attempt to construct a family enterprise in the Canadian North without what I would call the religious motivation as being central to it, which is quite different than, for example, the Christian church in Canada, which came almost, I think almost 100% to try to convert the Aboriginal peoples to Christianity. So there was an avowed religious orientation that became predominant in the relationship with Indigenous people through missions and all of that. That was not what the Islamic people, what the Muslims from Lebanon were concerned about. They were concerned to establish a community here that would sustain them and allow them to build successful businesses. So that that means then that you have to study Islam in Canada through a prism, through a lens, if you will, of what we would call in the West a secular model. In other words, that the driving force is not religious in intent. So you don't lay a religious model on trying to understand how the community developed. It was more what I would call a family, a connection, a leapfrogging of family from Lebanon to Montreal to Alberta, and then developing Alberta as a center for entrepreneurial activity. Beyond that, then, came the attempt to establish in a very real and powerful way social and cultural support for Muslim people. And they did it in such a way as not to alienate Christians or others, but to do it in consort with them. So, for example, the mosque started out by buying a piece of land from the city by people who, by businessmen who had a very good relationship with the city and who were very successful. And so the mayor didn't have any problems, you know, saying to them, well, sure, if you can raise the money, you can buy this piece of land and I'll sell it to you for $5,000. Well, who's going to do this? Are the businessmen going to go out and do this? No, it was the women who built the mosque, that is, financially. It was people who from families, and most of them wives and mothers, who decided that they were going to build this, the community this way. And they did it by an integral activity. Helwi went around. She was one of the wives of one of the early pioneers here. And she went around to all of the businessmen on the main street and said, you know, give us a donation so we can build a mosque. And she, Helwi Hamdan, was a brilliant woman. And she went to all of these businesses. And Helwi was a woman that you didn't say no to. And so she helped put together enough money that they could buy the plot. And then, you know, it just snowballed from there. They went on and on and on. And so one of the things that fascinated me was the role that women played in founding Islam in Edmonton and in Canada. And the role that women have played has been not put forward, in my view, as forcefully as it should be in terms of the founders of Islam in Canada. I don't know if that's so in the States. I my study of places in the States doesn't indicate to me that women play the same kind of role. So I guess what I would underline is that this kind of family connection with powerful women was critical, at least in the Al-Rashid Mosque story.
Now, people could probably imagine the types of activities that and the issues and the political and social concerns that the community is probably dealing with now. But what were the types of activities? What were the types of kind of global political discussions that were shaping communal decisions, you know, right after the founding in the mid 20th century? What was going on with the mosque during this kind of early period?
You mean before the founding of in 1938, before they built the?
No, pretty much. After the founding, what was the community doing in these kind of these early years? You know, you kind of make this break in the 70s. So, you know, before the kind of shifting political landscape during the 70s and then moving on, what's going on in the kind of the mid 20th century?
Well, in the mid 20th century, right, for example, after the war, they were consolidating their family's business model, that is the Arab families. And so there was the founding of the mosque was basically about 10 different families who went together to build the mosque. And then from there, they continued to build very solid businesses in Alberta. And the community itself, like Edmonton itself, had one of the best educational, public educational systems in Canada. And that assisted the community in building family strength. So many people came there because there was a strong, solid nucleus of Muslims there. And then they came to Edmonton because they wanted to give their children educational possibilities. And they saw the educational development of Edmonton to be very positive. So they came because of that. They also decided as business people that they weren't going to be what we would call highly political. In other words, as the rise of Israel and the whole issues that galvanized the Middle East became more and more predominant in the discourses about Islam, the community did not want to engage in that discussion because they thought, I think quite rightly, that they were in Canada and they wanted to adopt a kind of Canadian viewpoint about what Islam was. So they set about to build a community that was based on what I would call Canadian concerns. For example, in building the mosque, Hilwi Hamdan and others put on community dinners and provided absolutely fantastic food so that Albertans and Edmontonians were welcomed into the mosque basement where they held all of these meetings and held all of these dinners. And in the early days, there was no attempt to strike a different kind of social and cultural attitude. In the mosque basement, they had a piano, and one of the Ghanems was well known for his music. So they had dances in the basement. They had social activities in the basement. And they brought the community from outside into the mosque. And so there was a kind of easy relationship between the developing city of Edmonton and its diversity and the Muslims in the mosque. They did not see themselves as separate. They did not hive themselves off from the community because all of them, many of them, were very powerful businessmen in the community at large. And some of them made a great deal of money in Alberta at the time. So the mosque itself became a kind of cultural expression of an Islamic awareness in Canada. And so one of the overriding themes in my book is, how did this group develop a Canadian Islam? Now, I must say that theologically, I've had some criticism from people in the Middle East who say, well, you know, Islam is one kind of thing. It's not Canadian, or it's not Arab, or it's not Lebanese, or, you know, it's one kind of thing. And so I have said, but you have to see the way in which this community developed to understand that there is a Canadian Islam. There is an Islam that adapted to and felt at home in a Canadian environment. And there was never what I would call a separation complex, an attempt to hive off the community from integration into the larger community. And I think that's one of the secrets of Al-Rashid's success. And it has, in effect, because of its old relationship in Canada, it has in effect become a kind of icon in the development of Islam in Canada.
Now, beginning in the 1970s and then moving on from there, there's social change happening in the community. The community is becoming more diverse, and it's kind of its makeup. There's a movement to establish a new building as the mosque center, and then of course, you know, as we move into the later 70s and then the 80s and 90s, there's these kind of increasing political questions about the role of Muslims in the so-called West. Could you tell us a little bit about this period? And I guess this is the same time that you kind of entered the scene, just as a professor there. So what was happening during the 1970s? How did the community change? What made the need for a new building arise? How are these things developing at this period?
Yeah, that's a good question, because you see, the entire complex of Alberta as a society shifted from, you know, the 70s on, and that's when Alberta hit an oil boom, And the oil boom affected the Muslims particularly, because many of them were in Lac La Biche, were in the north, where there was a developing oil sands. And then, of course, the oil in central Alberta became a kind of international success. So all of these things contributed to a influx of Muslims who, for one reason or other, wanted to come. And one of the main reasons was that they wanted to get in on the development, on the extraordinary money that was flowing into the province at the time. So there was also what I would call a kind of depression about what was going on in the Middle East. You know, like the heartland of the Arabs, who were the founding fathers of this tradition, were totally in chaos, and the presence of Israel had kind of thrown them off, and so they really didn't know how to face local histories. So when they came to Canada, they really were looking at ways in which they could adapt to a Canadian society without the whole baggage of the Middle East attaching to them. And so, you know, when you look at the heartland territories and the complexities that they were facing, founding a community in Canada seemed to be the thing to do. So everybody, all the Muslims from various countries were coming here, and they were going to Alberta and to Edmonton and Calgary as a way of finding an entirely new kind of life. And then it's also true that at that time, Pierre Trudeau was prime minister, and during this period of time, Idi Amin, you know, kicked the one group of Muslims out of his country, the Ismailis, and Pierre Trudeau was a good friend of the Aga Khan, and they made a deal that Canada would take all of these refugees, and so many of these spread across the country, and a good many of them came to Alberta. And this was an entirely different Islamic tradition, and the Albertans were used to the Sunni Arab tradition, but they had to adapt now and understand that Islam was far more varied than what was expressed in the local mosque. At the same time, the success of Alberta and economically attracted Muslims to migrate to Canada. And of course, it's in this period of time that a good number of other people from Egypt, Iraq, Syria, Turkey, came to Alberta, and many of them were Sunnis, and so they would join in Al-Rashid. That's the period of time when it became obvious that the old mosque, the mosque built in 1938, could no longer support the community as it just exploded in numbers. And so it became necessary then for them to develop a new mosque. And the new mosque became the focal point then of developing what I would call an institutional Islam. An institutional Islam being one that had a definitive discipline, a concern for a certain kind of Islamic presence, and to take its place as a religious community within the larger framework of religions in Alberta. That's when the new Al-Rashid Mosque was developed, and they brought funding and enterprise and all of those things together in building this new mosque. So these kinds of things were intriguing to me as a scholar, and I watched this development over the many years I was there, which, as you can tell, I came to the university just as this thing was exploding and getting off the ground and the new mosque was being proposed and all of that. So it was really an exciting time, and everybody was looking forward to, you know, great things. And the Muslim community itself was attracting refugees and immigrants and from all different stripes of Islam. So it became a phenomenon. And I was looking on this from my position at the University of Alberta as a professor in Islamic studies, trying to understand how this is different than the Islam that I had studied in the Middle East.
Now, in the 80s and 90s, there's a kind of growing awareness of Muslims by Canadian neighbors, perhaps, kind of changing attitudes, perhaps about the role of their presence, the kind of simultaneity of being Muslim and being Canadian. How were Muslims understood and received by their non-Muslim community members before 9/11?
Well, that's a complex question. The early Muslims focused on building the community from within. And while they related to the people back in the Middle East, communication and interaction with them was minimal. So they really were on their own. They had to develop their own community. By the 70s, as you probably know, communications had just exploded. And so they were, you know, there was almost much more awareness of what was going on in the Middle East. As you are aware, Israel became a common topic then. What kind of perspectives are they going to have, are Muslims in Canada going to have towards, for example, the Palestinian issue? There were Palestinians in the mosque, and some of them wanted a more activist stance against Israel and what it was doing. There were also people in the mosque who said, this is not our business. Our business is not to deal with what's going on in the Middle East, even though our community comes from there. Our institutional role is not to take a political stand on Israel and what is going on in the Middle East. Our role here is to build a community that will sustain and support Muslims in this country. So there was a fragmentation within the community on what I would call its overall goals vis-a-vis what was going on in the Middle East. It's also true, I think, that many Muslims in Alberta had done so well for themselves, and they kept bringing their relatives to Canada and supporting them so that they could get established here, that their model of not dealing with political issues became a more predominant model in the way many people dealt with the whole Middle Eastern situation. And the conflict between various countries in the Middle East and the conflict with Israel and American involvement in the Middle East became an issue that for them was not something that they could solve. So therefore, they didn't want it pulling them down. Now, within the community itself, there were many people who thought that this was hiding your head in the sand. There are many people in the community who said, look, we have brothers and sisters who are killed and have suffered greatly because of what's going on in the Middle East politically. And we should take a stand against what's happening in the Middle East and put funds and resources into assisting them. But the predominant idea that survived this debate was that we are a Canadian group of Muslims, and we have to politically adopt a Canadian stance and not take a Middle Eastern stance, which is so complex and so chaotic. I think that's the focus that they had in the 70s, and they carried that focus right through until, you know, the rise of the right wing, especially in Saudi Arabia, with the rise of the Wahhabi tradition and the, shall we call it, the ultra-conservative viewpoint that predominated and gave way eventually to Al-Qaeda and what I would call the reactionary right wing. So from many people in the mosque, their stance on keeping out of political issues was the right thing to do. And I think probably from the perspective of what I could see, that paid them well, because they were able to develop then a community that not only was successful in Canada, but had, it was a model for other kinds of Muslims in other places in the world.
Now, the tragedy of 9/11 and its aftermath, also affected the Canadian Muslim community.
Very much, yeah.
And probably threw them into new kind of public light. So can you tell us kind of how the events of September 11th affected the Al-Rashid community, and how do they respond as an institution?
Oh, that's an interesting part of the whole story, actually. The initial thing, of course, was that the community was afraid. I mean, I knew many of these people personally, and they were afraid that Canadians would turn against them for something that Muslims had done on the other side of the world and for which they had no interest and really didn't participate in. So there was a great deal of fear in the community. And with good reason, because there were cases in which, you know, some right-wing Canadians would pointedly do things to, let's say, children, or would yell at women in the street who are wearing a hijab or whatever. And there was a tense kind of time, and they were concerned that Muslims not be stereotyped and not be pushed into an antagonism through elements that had nothing to do with them. So the community decided, I think, to go inward. In other words, to knuckle down on building themselves from within. And they decided then that what they would do is to try to develop an Islam, a deeper kind of institutional Islam. Now, they had, right from the beginning, tried to teach the Quran and Arabic in the mosque. In the basement of the old mosque, and then in the basement of the new. And they decided then that they were going to try to bring a more educational focus to the community and to Canadians. So what they did then was to move into what I would call public education, or an institutionalized Islamic educational model. So they threw some very important people, women again, one of them who had worked for many, many years in teaching, like Saraya Hafiz and Lila Fallman, both of whom were very well-known teachers within the Edmonton Public School Board. They developed an Arabic and an Arabic program that was then adapted into the public schools, and a couple of schools were chosen to teach Arabic. And from there, they decided to branch out into an Islamic school, and they built the Islamic Academy, the Edmonton Islamic Academy, in 2012. They founded this academy, and the goals of the academy were to present an Islamic education within the Canadian context that had excellence of delivery and excellence of scholarship at its heart. And I think they were largely successful with that. The Islamic Academy now has become one of the brightest spots in Islamic development in Alberta, and I think it's radiated out to other places in Canada. The Islamic Academy became the go-to place for Muslims who wanted to place their children in Islamic environments, and still to do it in a North American and Canadian context. And so they have put a great deal of money into developing educational organizations. They also branched out into what I would call youth training, Boy Scouts, Islamic Boy Scouts, young people's groups, women's auxiliaries. They have developed a whole range of Islamic organizational things in those years. So in other words, they took some of the models that they saw around them, and they focused upon some of the things that they thought were quintessentially Islamic and also quintessentially Canadian, and that was to develop an institutional organization and an educational orientation within the desires of the community in such a way that they could become part of the larger environment and still be Islamic in tone and character. So post 9/11, they did hunker down, but they focused on developing Islamic resources. And out of that has come, I think, an extraordinary achievement in terms of an Islamic community center and an educational development, which I think is a significant one in Canada.
Yeah, and the book really is a wonderful micro history that kind of gives us a vantage point to think about the whole kind of national history of Muslims in Canada. Dr. Wah, we're kind of coming to the end here. I want to give you the opportunity. You know, there's a lot more in this book, and it's really goes into great detail. You bring in a lot of voices from the community. And I want to give you the opportunity, if there's anything else you want to let listeners know about the book before we wrap it up, feel free to let us know.
Yeah, well, first of all, I didn't intend to write this book. I was asked to do it by the community. And the reason I was asked to do it by the community is because they thought that if they had an insider do it, the insider would place emphasis on one or other of the families, you know? And so there are tensions within the group about who it is that had the most to do with the development of the community and all that. So part of the reason why they asked me if I would do the book was they were having the 70th anniversary and they wanted a book that would kind of outline their history. So that's one point. The second point I want to make is that I never adopted any of the kind of academic, high academic ideologies that we have, you know, in the community now. I was not concerned to apply anything but a very kind of common historical model to this group. I was not concerned to find some kind of methodological significance in this group, which makes the book much more, I guess, popular than academic. And so I would say that, you know, I enjoyed writing this book because it brought me in touch with the community. There are other kinds of limits to doing that, and one is that I found in much of my work that there is a corporate loss of history and memory. So there are some things in the book that are there that should be changed if it's ever written again, because people had forgotten what had happened and they didn't give me all of the details of what happened. So, you know, when you write a book like this, you're really based on corporate memory. And I saw some of the limitations of that corporate memory when I did this book. Those are just a few notes about it. Al-Rashid Mosque itself, I think, is one of the leading mosques in Canada in terms of what they've constructed as a community. And I think their presence has radiated across Canada and probably into the States in some minor way. Would I write this book again? I would probably do it quite differently. Yeah.
Well, it is an excellent book, and I think you are really continuing to establish a history of Muslims in Canada, a good legacy for others to build on. And I know people were excited to hear that I was going to be speaking to you about the book. So congratulations on that. We always wrap these conversations up a little bit about what folks are working on now. And you know, you've had a long career and you seem like the type of person who's probably still plugging away. So if there are things you're working on, I would love to hear about them.
Well, Oxford, if you look up Oxford, I've done several things. After I retired from arts, I went over to medicine. And I taught in medicine at the University of Alberta because medicine in Canada was acutely aware of the fact that it did not have ethnic awareness built into its medical program. So, for example, there was all kinds of problems in medical students understanding how to deal with Muslim women. There were, and a good number of them had problems in understanding how to deal with Indigenous people. So they asked me to come over and to teach them about cultural difference and diversity. So I went there after I retired from arts, and my focus had been on medicine and medical issues. So I did several pieces for the Islamic Women's Study in Oxford, a dictionary of that. I've also done an article on, I guess you'd call it, the way in which Islam has developed in various areas in the United States and Canada, and how that's played a role in the definition of what we would call identity. So that article is still in the works someplace. It's going to be published by Oxford. So, I'm still working away. I have several things I could do. But one of the issues that I am thinking about is the way in which minority communities become aware in a new kind of cultural context. So how do Muslims or indigenous people who have been suppressed for so long in terms of what people think, how do they take their rightful place in a diverse cultural situation like we have in Canada? So I'm thinking about these. I haven't written anything about it yet, but I'm thinking about that.
Well, they sound like interesting questions, and from your long track record, I'm sure it'll be very worthwhile taking a look. So good luck on all of that, and thanks again for making the time to talk, Dr. Waugh.
Oh, you're welcome. So thank you very much for this chance to look back.